This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance. I did not kill my wife, and you don't care. And I believe I can fly, cause I'm the king of the world. From the 90s to nothing, I'll be there.
Kevin!
Place to Be Nation Pop. Welcome to the very first episode of the only show on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network talking about 1990s film. That's right, this is 90 to Nothing, Episode 1. And I am one of your hosts, Russell Sellers, and joining me is my longtime good personal friend, Mr. Sam Neely. How's it going tonight, man?
It's going awesome. How's it going with you, my friend?
Oh, we're
going
to take things to the extreme. Because that's what you do in the 90s.
Because it's the 90s. We have bleached hair. We have cargo pants.
Slap bracelets.
Slap bracelets all day long.
Every day. That's how we roll. And we roll on four wheels because skateboarding was totally the biggest and best thing in the 90s, right? Right?
No, yeah. No, my friend. We roll on eight wheels because we are rollerblading.
Oh, ho, ho. Oh, he takes it up a notch. All right, we're taking it all the way back. And since this is episode one, we had to take it all the way back to 1990. Because
that's right.
It's what gave the show its namesake that year, 1990. And being that this is also the holiday season, we had to start off the people with a true Christmas classic. We're talking about, of course, that John Hughes written, Christopher Columbus directed, Home Alone.
That's right.
And it's... Why do you think this movie is a Christmas classic, Sam? What does this movie do for you?
So, that's a good question. I would say, having rewatched it recently, it definitely holds up as nostalgia and as a Christmas classic. I don't know that it holds up as a movie. But I think the reason that it is because of the age that so many people who are, you know, our listeners, and so many people of us who are around the same age, we kind of grew up with this movie. This was a movie we saw when we were first learning what movies were.
It's very true. Like, this was kind of the beginning of our formative years of film watching. Like, whenever you were a kid, you were watching, you know, the basic Disney crap that your parents feed you because it's all safe and, you know, they feel like they can leave you in front of the TV for a little bit. Now, you're getting into a little bit of those, I guess, deeper meaning movies, and this type of film really spoke to a lot of us 90s kids, I think.
I think it did, because we were the hero.
Exactly. Like, we were all the heroes of our own story, and I think as horrible as it may be to say, we could all see ourselves in Kevin a little bit.
Oh, God. I'm sad to say that you're right, but yeah, you're right.
It's true, though. We were all little hellion bastards at some point, and I think that that's an apt description of Kevin in this movie, especially at the beginning.
Oh, God, yeah. But I would say he's also, and he's not the worst of the brood at the beginning.
Oh, Jesus, no. No. When you look at how terrible Kevin is, you think, wow, what a little shit. How awful is he?
Yeah.
And then you see the rest of the family, and you're like, yeah, I kind of get it now.
Absolutely. It's like, oh, Buzz.
Yeah, dear God. I think he might be the worst of the kids, though. It's a running contest. They all have their moments to be just awful.
And they do. It's the rest of his, in terms of his siblings, the rest of his siblings is just kind of being snarky asses to him.
It's true.
Which, the thing is, I'm from a large family, bigger than Kevin's, in terms of siblings. And the youngest of the brood is not the one that gets picked on when they're eight. It's when they're a teenager.
Yes, that makes sense. I am the oldest of only two, but I can also confirm that this is true.
Yes.
And, you know, I kind of agree with you that this, for nostalgia's sake, this movie does hold up. But having also rewatched it recently, as a movie, it really doesn't. There's just too much here that just seems, you know, too much for even my suspension of disbelief. I just can't reach for it. for that level, I guess. And
right.
It starts off right here at the beginning, you know, with them saying that they're this whole family, this group of 15 people, are all going to go to Paris on one dude's dime, on Peter yes. McAllister's dime.
No, they're not going on Peter McAllister's dime. They're going on his brother Rob's dime.
Oh, his brother Rob is paying for the trip. Okay, I've always mistaken that. Then okay.
At least that's how I heard it was the when she's explaining what's going on that she's saying that Rob's kids stayed in Chicago to go to school after Rob got transferred to Paris, and that he surprised them all with a trip to Paris for the holidays.
And that's all well and good, but it also begs the question: my God, what does this one dude do for a living?
I don't know. I mean, if he's getting transferred to Paris, he's got a good job.
Right?
I do know that there's apparently, and this is just one of those internet things that floats around, so I can't confirm it, but apparently in the novelization of the film, they say that his dad is a business, that at least Peter McAllister is a business executive, and Kate McAllister is a high-end fashion designer. That's backed up by the unusual number of mannequins and clothing patterns in the house.
Yeah, that's something that they certainly do not talk about in this movie, and watching it as an adult, I was like, where did these mannequins suddenly come from? This has got to be the creepiest ass house in the world. Yeah. Not to mention, like, that house that they live in is huge.
Oh, yeah.
And
but you know what I noticed about it?
Was that?
At no point do you ever see where Kevin's room is.
You are absolutely correct. There is no time do we ever actually see Kevin's room.
Yeah, like you assume that because his cousins are in town, one of them or two of them are in his room.
Yeah.
So that's why he has to sleep in the attic. But he's supposed to sleep in the attic. Oh, also, it's got an attic and a basement like a that you can stand up in both.
Yeah, that is nuts. There's no way any house is laid out that way. I don't think the real house that this place is modeled in actually has that.
I think that the interior shots were actually filmed inside a set inside an abandoned gym.
That makes a lot of sense. And what's really cool is that they pretty much did shoot this entire movie on location in Chicago.
Yeah.
With different little stand-in places used for the Parisian scenes. Specifically, the O'Hare Airport is pretty much every airport in this movie.
That makes sense.
And as it turns out, the address that Kevin gives someone later in the movie about his house is actually is actually the actual address of the house.
Interesting. But so which one? Because he gives it once to Santa, he gives his real one to Santa, and then yep. He gives the neighbor's address to the 911 operator.
Yeah, it's the his actual address that he gives.
His actual address is the address of that house. That's crazy. Yeah.
671 Lincoln Avenue.
Yep.
But it's not located in Chicago. It's located in Winnetka, Illinois.
Okay.
That house in 2011 was put up for sale at $2.4 million and eventually sold the next year for $1.5 million.
Oh, God. Well, but look at it.
Yeah, it's huge. This is a monster house. Even back in 1990, I'm sure that its property value was very high.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you understand why Harry and Marv were obsessed with this neighborhood.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, calling that house the Silver Tuna of this neighborhood, dead-on description.
Absolutely. Also, they were pretty excited about the fact that nobody in the house had heard of a security system.
but speaking of Harry and Marv, we see Harry right at the beginning of the movie, and he's dressed as a police officer.
Yes, he is.
Who just happened to walk into someone's house. Nobody called him. Nobody was asking for a security check on the home. But here he is, not only standing in their house, but being ignored by every single person.
Yes, but I love one thing that I always remember, because I was so young when I saw this movie. I always remember the random little nicknames he throws at people. He's like, man, son, big fella, little guy.
Yeah, he's doing his Joe Pesci thing. He's definitely channeling some Lethal Weapon to Leo Getz. Which also has a small Easter egg in the movie on the side of the Wet Bandit's van, because his catchphrase was okay. It's okay plumbing or cleaning and plumbing on the side of the van.
I didn't notice that, but you know, I haven't watched the Lethal Weapons all the way through.
Sure, and he's it's just mind-blowing to me that here's this cop standing around in this house. I grew up in the 90s. Granted, I didn't grow up in a neighborhood quite like this, but I can't imagine something like this actually happening. Like, this cop just walks into the house and the adults don't say anything.
I feel like somebody, like, the implication is somebody let him in and then just kept walking. Like, they opened the doors, they come in, and then just kept walking.
That has to be it, because there's nothing else that would make any sense. Eventually, you know, the pizza guy arrives, and he immediately gets attention, I guess, because he's bringing food.
Yeah.
And that's when...
But then nobody will pay him.
Yeah, and then it takes forever for him to actually get paid. And here's the cop, Joe Pesci, who is actually, we don't know this at the beginning of the movie, but it's Harry. Disguise, scoping out houses that he and his partner intend to rob, or burglarize, I guess, because no one is going to be home. At least that's their hope. And this is a pretty spot-on police costume. I'm wondering where he got it.
I have no idea, but it's because you see real cops later in the movie, and it's the same one. Even did a quick search for the flag on his shoulder.
Yeah, it's like, it's dead on.
It's a Chicago flag that was really popular.
And, you know, another thing this movie does right from the start is it goes ahead and foreshadows all the traps that are going to happen in the third act. But
all of them. Okay, I didn't notice that. I did notice the micro machines.
Yeah, the micro machines thing, talking about the ornaments with the fish hooks.
That's right.
That's going to be used later. The hot glue gun.
Right. Every time. Like, there's so much new stuff that you pick up every time you watch this movie.
And you really have to watch for it, but it's great to have such eagle-eyed people out there who've written, like, whole dissertations on this movie.
Oh, yeah. Because there's a lot of stuff that, you know, that a lot of people... Like, I caught new things because I was taking notes when I was watching this latest time. And there's new things that I caught that I was like, oh, my God, I never realized this before.
And it's really nuts how these... how all this stuff happens. There's one important bit at the beginning of the movie that I think a lot of people, I definitely missed it my first few times watching the film, but when Kevin and Buzz get into it over Buzz having eaten apparently all of Kevin's plain cheese pizza.
Yeah, Buzz ordered the pizza, and yeah, he didn't order a cheese pizza. I know, I catch that every time. I've got that in my things nobody knows, like, you know, stuff you may have missed.
Yeah, so there was no cheese pizza because Buzz was doing it just to mess with Kevin.
Yeah.
Kevin, like, has been told earlier in the film that he has to share a bed with his cousin Fuller, who's definitely going to pee on him.
Oh, yeah.
And he's seeing, like, all of this is just culminating in this one little bit of irritation. He attacks Buzz, knocks over, like, all this milk, which, my God, who drinks milk with pizza?
So, the milk is because when Kate walks in, she says, I hope you're all drinking milk, I want to get rid of it, because they're about to be in Paris for a while, and milk goes bad.
Sure.
So, she put a bunch of glasses of milk out for everyone to drink.
And Kevin knocks every bit of that over.
Yep.
And when his dad reaches over with a bunch of napkins to try and, clean up the milk and move people's passports and plane tickets out of the way.
He throws Kevin's out.
Yep, he picks up Kevin's plane ticket and throws it in the trash.
And you know, I was looking at it when I was watching it, and it looks like he picked up a passport and threw it out too, which that's like, ooh, those are expensive.
Yeah, it's like, uh-oh. You would think he would have paid a little bit better attention, but then again, you'd think everybody in this movie would have paid better attention to what was going on, but no, they're the...
Absolutely.
Dirt worst at that. And speaking of Buzz, who the hell names their kid Buzz?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, is it a nickname? But what is it short for? Like,
it does not say, because in the
BuzzFeed, it's BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed McAllister.
That, you know what? I'll accept it. And that actor has gone on to do quite a bit of, like, small bit stuff over the years. I'm a big fan of the TV show Supernatural, and apparently he was on an episode of that, and I
didn't recognize him. Yeah, the last thing, he looks different, but the last thing I saw him in was Surrogates with Bruce Willis. He played the IT guy.
Oh, God, I didn't even realize that.
He was really heavyset guy with the long red hair who doesn't use a surrogate because apparently his brain is too powerful to go into a robot or something like that. That's Buzz.
See, I never actually watched Surrogates, so I was not aware of any of that.
Yeah. One role, though, around the same time as Home Alone that I remember is, you know, just a few years later, being a kid, still going to kids' movies, watching Dennis the Menace, and he plays the babysitter's boyfriend. Because I remember we were watching it with my dad, and the babysitter's boyfriend shows up, and my dad goes, "Oh, it's Buzz!"
Let's talk about some of the other characters that we've seen here in this opening scene, specifically Uncle Frank. I mean, of all the people who are like really shitty in this movie,
he's the worst.
He's got to be. Because for one, yeah, Kevin did cause this accident. He should have controlled himself better. But I'm sorry, you don't walk into my house and call my kid a little jerk. That's a quick way to find yourself sleeping in the snow.
Oh, yeah. Also, if you see what happened to Uncle Frank, Kevin didn't do shit. Kevin's dad poured Pepsi on Uncle Frank because he dropped the Pepsi bottle halfway through pouring it.
Yes. If he'd have just, you know, taken a minute, set the bottle down, none of that would have happened.
Yeah.
So it's really on Kevin's
dad. I do want to digress a little on the Pepsi bottle thing because we had this movie on VHS when I was a kid. We didn't watch it a lot because my mom didn't like the part where Buzz tells Kevin, "I wouldn't let you sleep in my room if you were growing on my ass." So we didn't get to watch it a lot. But the previews beforehand, there was only like maybe one preview for like Fern Gully, but then there was a commercial for Pepsi and a commercial for American Airlines, which are two of the biggest product placements in this film.
Oh, yeah.
And because the line that they use to kind of make Kevin even madder after it's already been established that Fuller wets the bed is when Fuller's mom goes, "Fuller, go easy on the Pepsi." And Fuller, like, takes a sip and then looks at the camera and smiles with the logo facing out just like a commercial.
Exactly. This movie is like a giant commercial for Pepsi and American Airlines.
Oh, and this actually brings me to two really great, or not great, nothing about my stories is great, but two interesting stories that I have. One is, my cousin Chris and I were watching this on Thanksgiving probably 10 or 12 years ago. And it got to that part, and we were like, "What is with the product placement?" And that sort of kicked off this game that we played. Every time we went to the movies, it became a contest of who could point out the product placement.
And
we would keep score.
And there's a tremendous amount in movies.
Oh, it's all over. Like, we had to come up with rules. Like, if something is owned by a parent company or a sister company, then it's off limits. You can't do, like, Pepsi and then also Mountain Dew. There was a whole thing. But the other thing that I noticed, probably about 5 years ago, it came on TV. And I think it was ABC Family or something like that. And they were showing, you know, Home Alone. And, of course, Coca-Cola is the official corporate sponsor of the birth of Jesus in America these days.
Yeah.
So, you know, Coca-Cola was one of the sponsors of the program. There was a Coke commercials every commercial break. So not only did they take out Fuller Go Easy on the Pepsi, they blurred out the Pepsi logos in that scene.
Like, oh, you gotta love it.
If I didn't know better, I'd have thought it was a table of dildos that they had to take out.
Oh, you gotta love when the corporates step in and say, "Oh God, we can't have our rivals in there."
No, not at all.
Dear,
you know,
God.
I'm an Atlanta resident, so you know, go Coca-Cola and all, but still, what the hell?
Yeah, that's the great lengths that people will go to censor things in movies. Even this movie is not immune. So
no, not at all.
Now we've talked about how like shitty most of this family is, but I think that it's the worst thing that they do, of course, is leave Kevin behind after he's been banished to the attic, and through a weird series of fate, the power and phone lines get knocked out during the night while everyone is asleep, and when the shuttle buses or the shuttles vans, if you will, show up to pick up the family, they're all still in bed asleep.
Oh yeah.
Panic ensues and they just freaking forget Kevin because this random ass neighbor kid wanders over and is mistaken for Kevin during a head count.
Yep, because he's just going through their stuff. And you know what? Did we not all have that neighbor kid in our neighborhood?
You know, I didn't because I grew up kind of out in the middle of nowhere, but I absolutely believe that in every neighborhood that kid does exist.
Oh yeah, my brothers had some friend that they played with who came into my room and was like, "Oh whoa!" Like opening my drawers, "You have a $2 bill?" And I'm like, "Fuck, get out of here, kid!"
It's like, "Who are you?"
Yeah, it's the kid from Home Alone. He just sort of wanders through the neighborhoods, is that this, going through all your stuff.
Is that this kid just showed? Okay, he's here.
Now that frantic scene where they're all running through the house. Actually, I want to bring up the music playing is, it's like this variation on the Nutcracker that's enough like one of the Nutcracker themes, but without being the Nutcracker theme. And that's what I kind of want to bring around to how John Williams like almost created an entirely new neoclassical Christmas music experience in this movie. So now you hear Home Alone music and you think Christmas.
Exactly. John Williams is a brilliant composer, and it's kind of amazing that he's the one that did the music for this movie. I never put it together until just a few years ago that, my God, that really is his music. Like, you can hear it.
It is there.
The opening theme to Home Alone, though, I would say wouldn't be out of place in a 1990s Tim Burton movie.
Not at all.
It has a Danny Elfman quality to it.
It really does. And I think that the way that the title sequence is done kind of helps that along, too.
Yeah, it was around the same time as Edward Scissorhands, and that's what it really reminds me of.
Yeah.
So that may be another movie we talk about on a future episode.
Oh, absolutely. Wait, or wasn't that 89?
It might have been, yeah. That one may have just missed the mark, but Tim Burton shall make an appearance in this list somewhere.
Yes. As a guest. Please, Mr. Burton.
That would be great.
I promise I won't be too mean to you.
No, we'll praise all of your movies, especially your original pieces. Hey, we could always talk Batman Returns. That came out in the
night. We could talk Nightmare too.
There you go.
We have to wait for next Christmas.
Hey, you know, it may have to take a backseat to the sequel to this movie.
It might. Yeah, that's a good point.
Now,
I mean, if you want to go through Christmas movies in the 90s, that's, you know, I was a kid going to the movies in the 90s. Of course I know the Christmas movies.
Now, let me ask you this. While Kevin's here, you know, home alone, and he's just discovering that he's been left behind, he goes down, you know, down into the basement, and we, as you mentioned before, this is a tall-ass basement.
Yes.
And it seems scary as hell. Did you have a place like that in your house that just, like, freaked you out as a kid?
I had nothing in my house that scared me, no.
Okay.
Now, in my grandparents' house, there was a vintage mirror sign of, like, from the 18 or the early 1900s, of, like, a Coca-Cola advertisement, like, you know, drink Coca-Cola, 5 cents, whatever. It was a giant mirror, but there's this painting on it of a woman who's, like, wearing so much makeup that she's just like stark white, and she's holding a little glass of Coca-Cola, and it's really, really creepy because she was just too white.
Also product placement.
I remember being afraid of like being in the kitchen at my grandparents' house. Like everybody went out to go swimming, and so I went to the bathroom, and then I was going to go out and go swimming, and then I couldn't get through the kitchen, and so I just sat on the floor and cried until my mom found me.
Jesus.
But, you know, as fate would have it, my parents bought that house from my grandparents. It became my older childhood home, and that giant Coca-Cola sign is still in there. But I'm not scared of it anymore.
Well, that's good.
What was yours?
None really. We didn't have a basement or really much of an attic to speak of. But, you know, as a young kid, the house, like, I would be kind of freaked out by certain noises that would happen at night, or just in like the darker corners of the house. So stuff like that would always trip me out. So I kind of related to Kevin's response to going down to the basement and seeing the furnace kick on, which he imagines as some kind of a monster, and it scares him out of the basement.
Yes,
and he just kind of goes, you know, he just goes crazy in this house. While his parents are gone, like making just all sorts of mischief, going through his older brother's stuff. Now, I do want to to point out that Buzz's issue of Playboy is broadcast nudes. The TV newscasters bear it all.
I kind of wonder if they picked that one because it's the front cover is not salacious at all. Like, because it is a kid's movie, they could have their joke about, oh, he's grossed out by a Playboy, it's funny, but without it being something that would be, that the kids would look at and actually see what it is, but the adults could maybe get the joke.
I think that that is a reasonable way of looking at that. That makes a lot of sense to me, because there's nothing risque about that cover at all.
No, I didn't get the joke when I saw the movie the first time.
See, it then it worked exactly as planned. I think that scene is also maybe the most problematic scene in the movie. Because Kevin...
Buzz's girlfriend?
Yeah, Kevin fat-shames the hell out of Buzz's girlfriend and then breaks the glass frame. or the glass in the frame. Like, he's... My God, you Kevin, you're a little shit.
Interesting piece of trivia. The Buzz's girlfriend...
is not a girl.
It's a boy, yeah.
Yeah, that is a... I forget who that actually is. It's producer's son.
Somebody who's related to somebody, yeah.
And Chris Columbus wanted it to be a boy dressed as a girl because he thought that using an actual girl would be too cruel.
Yeah.
So, okay, slight points away from it, you're still fat shaming. But
true. I would say, though, you could – I agree. But there's also, I think, a point that it was more than just a weight thing, too.
Yeah,
even down to the expression.
It was,
but at the same time, you know, we all have those pictures of us that look terrible, and they could definitely be used in a movie like that, and we would feel like shit for it. So,
oh, for sure, for sure. Like, it's not nearly as bad as like certain other movies in the 90s. And I actually think that this movie might have been trying to be low key progressive at one point. So I'll call that out in a little bit when we're talking about the Wet Bandits. But did you ever, like, Kevin goes on the same binge that I think we all go on the first time we're left alone in our house and we know we're going to be there by ourselves for a while? He eats horribly. He breaks out the ice, multiple flavors of ice cream with marshmallows, syrup, soda, and chips, and that's what he's going to have for, I guess, it's either breakfast or lunch that he's eating while watching Angels with Filthy Souls. So did you ever do anything like that whenever you were a kid?
Not a whole lot, because we didn't have really any, we didn't buy a lot of ice cream when I was a kid, or not even specifically ice cream, but chips or anything like that. I think the most I ever did was, at one point, I made some weird concoction out of sugar, lemon juice, and raisins.
Oh, God.
Yeah, no, I don't recommend that.
We do not condone the mixing of these things.
I do not condone the mixing of any of those. And then there was a time that we tried to make cheese sauce, and we didn't know the physics of how to make cheese sauce or how to work a stove, so we made it in the microwave. We put cheese and butter in a plastic cup and microwaved it. I looked at the microwave, and it was lopsided, and we realized the cup was melting. So we turned off the microwave and went outside because we knew that the house was about to catch fire from our mistake. It didn't, luckily. House is still there. How about you? What was your
kid favorite? Logic. Now, I think that mine was just, I could take down, you know, any of the bags of chips in the house. That was a real issue for me. Ice cream didn't become a thing until later in life for me. But yeah, I definitely loved any like chips, and I was a peanut butter fiend as a kid. So that is something
I'm a peanut butter fiend now.
Yeah, I could put it on anything and it was great. But moving on from that, when the parents finally realize what's happened, they're like already over the Atlantic, you know, heading into France. I felt like their reactions were, you know, pretty close to authentic, although Peter McAllister never really seems all that upset about his son being left home alone.
He doesn't. He's just kind of, like, there's the one scene where he's on the phone trying to yell at somebody, but he's just sort of exasperated by that point.
Yeah, that's all it is. He's tired of having to put up with this, which kind of feeds into my own fan theory that I think Peter McAllister planned to murder his whole family. I think that this whole trip was a convenient way for him to get them all together. And
I'm kind of biased towards that theory because didn't John Hurt actually get in some trouble with the law later on? I know he passed away recently.
That is entirely possible. I'm not as familiar with John Hurt. I do remember really hating him in the movie Big.
He
was
bad guy.
Oh yeah, well he was meant to be that. He was a real piece of shit. And in this movie, he's just kind of here.
He's there because Kevin needed a dad because he had a quote unquote normal nuclear family.
And I mean, to his credit, he does the best he can with what he's got. There's not much there because I mean, the true male leads of this movie, outside of Macaulay Culkin as Kevin, is Joe Pesci and Daniel Hurt.
Oh yeah, Daniel Stern.
Daniel Stern, excuse me, not Dan. Daniel Stern, Joe Pesci. And they are absolutely my favorite part of this movie.
They are a lot of fun.
I love pretty much every scene that they're in together because of just the natural chemistry between the two.
They really do. Yeah, I agree. They really do have that, like, in a way that I feel like it's part of, and I may be jumping the gun here, I feel like a big part of the legacy of this movie is that before this, yeah, there were other movies where kids faced off against bumbling idiot criminals, you know, like the Goonies. But after this, every kids movie was about that.
Yeah.
Even movies that were you go later in Macaulay Culkin's time, you got Richie Rich, you got all these movies that you feel like weren't actually written to have this in them, but somebody felt like they had to write in some bumbling idiot criminal for the kid to fight against.
That's pretty much it. This is the invention of a new subgenre of film. A new subgenre of holiday film, even. Because there are a lot of holiday movies that have also ripped this one off incessantly. So, I do really like how they develop those two characters. Even though they are portrayed as bumbling idiots, they do get some pretty funny lines in there as well.
And they have a good contrast in being different kinds of bumbling idiots, because you've got Harry is kind of the smart one and Marv is the dumb one,
yeah.
Even though they're both pretty dumb.
They do fill the roles for each other to play off of. And I don't know if you noticed this, but at one point while they're robbing a house across the street or well within Kevin's neighborhood, and they realize that through an answering machine message that the McAllisters are indeed gone and they should go back and try to rob the house again. Harry has a wedding ring on.
I actually noticed it while they were robbing the McAllisters' house. When he, after he's burned his hand and he tries his other hand on the back door, then I noticed that he had a wedding ring on.
Yep, he's wearing a wedding ring and no wife or kids are ever mentioned for either of these two characters in the movie. So, and there's another part of the movie when they're going through the traps and just being, obliterated by Kevin. Harry lands on top of Marv, and there's no, prototypical or stereotypical 90s homophobia reaction to it. It's just there. It's just a thing that happens. Like, this is something that they are used to. So, in my head, this is a married gay couple.
It's likely.
It seems like it is a thing that is definitely happening here, and they just didn't expressly say it, but I kind of think that Harry and Marv had more than just a partnership going on.
Maybe so. I guess we'll never know.
We won't.
R.I.P. John Hughes.
Yes, it's one of those things that we're never going to get the full answer to, but I like that as part of my own headcanon. Yeah, it's my headcanon for this movie. And speaking of which, like, we get all these product placements, as you mentioned, but there's one glaring one that is left out, and it makes no sense to me. They use a take on Little Caesars they call Little Nero's Pizza in this movie. But for some reason, I guess Little Caesars thought they were too good for this flick?
So I think, and I've thought about this for a while, and I think it's because there's a recurring gag that people that pull up to the McAllister's house knock over their little statue.
Yeah.
The little Caesars guy does it, or the little Nero's guy does it. The airport thing, there's a scene where when the airport bus is there, you see a guy picking up the statue and putting it up. So I think that's part of it. I think also around that time, the pizza places that had that 30 minutes you don't pay thing were trying to phase that out. But that's kind of part of the little Nero's thing. He's pulling up so fast because 30 minutes the pizza's free.
Sure.
And there's one thing I noticed just in this latest time that I watched it, and I never caught this before, but on the little Nero's truck, it actually has the little Nero's slogan, "No fiddling around," which is a reference to Nero fiddling while Rome burned. And I never caught that before.
That is a great catch. I never saw that before. I'm going to look for that the next time I watch the movie.
It's great. I don't know if it's in the beginning. I don't remember if you actually see the car in the beginning, but it is in the scene where Kevin orders the cheese pizza for himself.
It'll probably be clearer there, I think, because the car comes up so fast that you can almost miss it the first time. But yeah. But you can definitely catch it that next time. Funny joke for parents that I don't know if kids would necessarily, they may have caught this one, but did you notice that the police officer's name when his mom is calling cops from Paris to go and check on her son, she gets transferred to the family crisis line?
Yes.
Sergeant's name is Sergeant Balzac.
I did notice that. Also, that actor that plays Sergeant Balzac, I don't know his name. I meant to look it up, and I didn't. But in Seinfeld, when they created a show within the show, the Jerry show within the show,
yeah,
that actor played the Kramer, their Kramer stand-in.
I got you. His name is Roberts Blossom.
Roberts Blossom. That sounds like a name.
It does. It's a totally real, not made-up name.
It does, yeah. It's definitely a name and not a specialty cocktail.
You can also find him in movies like Escape from Alcatraz, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Christine. So he's
okay.
He's been around a little bit.
I've seen him in a lot. I've seen him in a lot, but specifically is just kind of where I'm like, oh yeah, he's fake Kramer.
He's that guy for this
man.
He is that guy. He's another one of those that guy actors. Now, I do have to ask, we've kind of talked about some characters that we like and some characters we hate, but who would you say is the most likable character in this movie?
The Furnace.
The Furnace?
Furnace has the best line.
Hello!
Oh, Kevin! And then Kevin retorts with, shut up!
No, honestly, really, no, I have a hard time finding likable characters in this movie. I like Marv. I don't know why, I just like the stupid crook. The old man, it's kind of rude, because my own headcanon is that the old man Marley, who we haven't really mentioned yet.
No, we haven't.
The rumor is that he murdered his whole family with a snow shovel, and then he sprinkles salt to turn the bodies into mummies. You know, it's just a spooky story that Buzz is telling Kevin.
That's totally something that Buzz made up off the top of his head.
My headcanon is that he is that there was a shovel slayer and he did kill all those people. Because later he meets Kevin, he says, you know, there's a lot of stuff going around about me, but none of it's true. Well, there he's just referring to the mummies. Of course, obviously that part's not true.
Clearly.
But no, I think he actually did kill. That's why he got into a fight with his son. He wanted his son to become a shovel slayer. His son had just had a daughter and didn't want to do that anymore. And so they got into a fight. Because at the end, what does he do? He shows up and saves Kevin with a shovel,
yep.
And then instead of staying around to wait for the police, he's like, let's go ahead and flee the scene.
Yeah, he's like, we're just going to go ahead and take you home. I can't be here being seen.
I can't be here. I can't be seen.
Oh, God. Now I'm starting to think that he probably did kill someone.
Yeah, I think so. So at the same time, then, maybe he is my favorite character. Maybe he's the shovel slayer.
He's
Ben Shovel Slayer.
Maybe he's redeemed himself that way, that's what he was looking for. I think I actually do lean towards Marv being my favorite character in the movie, just because of the physical comedy that Daniel Stern does so well.
Oh, absolutely.
And he actually does have some pretty witty lines. Plays off of Joe Pesci incredibly well. So yeah, he kind of becomes the most likable character in the movie, and he's the villain, one of the villains, and that's really saying something. Even though I would suggest that Kevin kind of goes on that hero's journey in an inverse "It's a Wonderful Life" kind of way.
That's a good point. I've never thought of it that way, but it does make sense. Yeah. Also, "It's a Wonderful Life" being referenced in both movies, in French in this one and in Spanish in the second one.
Yep. It's definitely an influence on this film, but I would also say that this movie is not only the inverse of "It's a Wonderful Life," it's an inverted take on "Merry Christmas, Charlie Brown."
That's not a Charlie Brown Christmas.
I think I've seen it referred to as both, but it's the same movie.
Okay, the original one. Okay,
yep.
You're gonna have to explain that because I don't see a connection there at all. I see it as more like a lot of different fantasy morality tale type things, where basically it's just a typical "be careful what you wish for" kind of tale, but instead of using a magical method of getting him his wish, they just use a natural method of a bunch of ridiculous coincidences.
And by inverted Charlie Brown, I mean that Kevin is the one dishing out the punishment rather than being the one to take it.
I see.
And he, but you still get the scene of him cutting down and decorating his own rather small and pathetic looking Christmas tree.
That's true.
So there's a little bit of that in there, but it's most definitely more an inverted "It's a Wonderful Life." And instead of an angel being in this movie, you get a devil. And the devil in this movie, I think, is John Candy.
No kidding. I don't know if I agree that, because I was just rethinking my favorite character thing, and I think maybe it's John Candy.
I'll explain. In the
Gus Polanski is his character's name.
Yes. He is the Polka King of the Midwest.
That's right, which is a... That's a reference to Ferris Bueller, or it's not a reference to Ferris Bueller?
You know, I don't know, but I need to watch Ferris Bueller again.
I don't remember if Abe Froman was the Sausage King of Chicago or the Sausage King of the Midwest?
Sausage King of Chicago.
Okay, then never mind. It's probably not.
But this, in this case, John Candy's character shows up in the Scranton airport after poor Kate McAllister has just basically sacrificed everything she owns or everything she has on herself to get from one airport to another, because she just refused to sit around and wait for that that Friday flight that could have gotten her and her family home, because she's tripped out about you know, getting back to her son as soon as possible. So she's separated from the family, flying solo, and she's stuck in this airport just desperately trying to get from Scranton, Ohio to Chicago, Illinois.
Is she in Ohio or Scranton, Pennsylvania?
It could have been either. They're not specific. They just said Scranton.
Okay.
And she is on the verge of just losing what's left of her mind, and says that she will give up everything she owns and that she would sell her soul to the devil himself in order to get back to her son. And just as she has said this, who would tap her on the shoulder but one John Candy, who happens to have a way for her to get home by offering her a ride. And I think that this is a clever way for the devil to say, "Oh, well, you put your soul up for sale, and I'm giving you a ride to get there, so, you know, deal's a deal. Your soul is mine."
Okay.
It's just one of the little headcanon pieces that I put into this movie to make it
more entertaining. I think it's going to become part of my headcanon now, too.
And
I'm stealing your headcanon.
Another clue that Harry and Marv may actually be a gay couple is... Marv's inability not to take the same kind of souvenir out of every house that they rob, a snow globe, which he proceeds to stick to the dash of the van that they're driving around in.
With his gum.
With his gum.
So, see, I see that as just his, it's kind of his secondary quirk. It's kind of, you know, he believes in leaving on the water because that's the calling card. I think he also believes in taking a snow globe as his trophy case.
And he's also the nicer of the two of the bandits, because whenever they almost run over Kevin with their van, Harry's being a real like dick about it, and Marv is kind of poking him in the, you know, the side, like, hey, you know, you did almost hit the kid. You could, you know, be a little nicer here. So,
but then he also says Santa Claus don't visit the funeral homes, little buddy. I didn't see that as a nice thing.
But he does make Harry at least tell the kid Merry Christmas.
That's true.
And this is where Kevin like really screws up, though, because if he'd have just, you know, non-reacted to that and walked away, none of the third act would have happened. They wouldn't have like just stalked this kid all the way back to his house.
Well, they didn't. They didn't, though. They caught him later.
Yeah, they
because they were staking out the house again.
They figure it out later, but they are chasing this kid down the street in their van, which is just weird. It's also strange to me that Kevin doesn't just get up on the sidewalk instead of just running in the middle of the street.
Because you know that this takes place in a universe where stranger danger is a thing, because he uses stranger danger not to not tell the cashier where he lives.
Exactly. And how quick-witted was he in that whole situation? I think the cashier had a begrudging respect for him that she had to have known that he's definitely not here with his mom out in the car.
Yeah.
And she's hitting him with all the fastball questions, but he's just hitting them all right back to her. Like he's just
What's she gonna do?
Right. He's got this all figured out. Now we've talked about the most likable character. Which character did you hate the most in this movie?
The furnace. No.
We're back to the furnace again. The furnace is the best and the worst character.
I mean, is there any other answer but Uncle Frank? You Buzz know, has the excuse of being a douchey teenager. Like, it's not a good excuse, but, like, Buzz is the worst character in the second movie.
Oh,
but,
yeah,
but in this one, no, it's Uncle Frank. He's the worst.
No, I'm pretty sure the worst character in the second movie is Donald Trump.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true.
But
why has he got to ruin things by being real life terrible?
Yeah, why has he got to ruin things by, you know, being in
existence?
And I would say that Buzz has one redeeming moment at the end of this movie, though, because he actually, you know, gives Kevin a little credit for not like destroying the house and for surviving on his own for a little while, which was okay. That was a nice gesture of him. Of course, tensions will be reignited just as soon as Buzz walks into his room and sees the damage done. Of course, I think as the family goes through the house and sees all the stuff that Kevin has done in their absence, there is no way that they're going to just, you know, write that off and new tensions won't arise as a result.
There's no way, but at the same time, he's got so much over them now.
He does.
The amount of guilt that they're all going through for leaving him.
I mean, he'll be able to hold that over their head probably for years to come. Now we've talked about our own. I've talked about a few of my like hidden items and themes and fan theories. Which do you have any of your own? That
mine is the Shovel Slayer. He is actually the Shovel Slayer.
That's the real one.
That's my real fan theory. Yeah.
Okay. Did you see any like hidden themes in this movie? Do you think that there's something that the like an artistic expression that the filmmakers or writers were trying to say?
I didn't see anything necessarily like deeper or philosophical, maybe just because I know, like, every time I watch it, I get more out of it, but it's more from a strictly story perspective. There's so many little things in the story that come back around and little details that are actually kind of important. Like, you know, it was only a couple of years ago that I realized that Kevin's ticket gets thrown away. It was maybe a year ago that I realized Buzz ordered the pizza. Even little things like when his dad is trying to remember what they forgot, and he's saying, "That's it, I forgot to close the garage." Well, that comes around with Kevin running up to and seeing the cars and saying the cars are still here because the garage is open.
And it's kind of weird
to me. So many little things, yeah.
That was another one of those things where I was like, did they not make it expressly clear to everyone that they were being picked up at the house? And Kevin just, I guess he just wasn't listening. I mean, that seems plausible.
Well, and when you're that age, because when you're 8, you know, somebody's going to pack his suitcase.
Sure.
He's afraid to pack his suitcase, but somebody's going to pack it for him. He knows, like, at some level, he knows all this stuff is going to happen. He's going to be taken care of. He sees oppression, and what's really happening is the family, the parents, as terrible as everyone in that family is, the family is the one buying the food. The family is the one that's doing all, and he has to learn how to do a lot of that stuff on his own. It also, though, does make me think about the fact that he says, I can't seem to find my toothbrush. Obviously, his parents packed up his toothbrush and took it to Paris. That's why he can't find his toothbrush.
Exactly.
Just so many little things that you don't really think about until you're, like everything kind of fits. There aren't a lot of, like, everything's sort of accounted for somewhere in the script. The fact that they have a doggy door is accounted for with his mom's, like, first or second line where she says, no, we didn't know we're not taking the dog. We put the dogs in the kennel.
And that's why, as you were saying, like John Hughes picked Chris Columbus to direct the movie to avoid plot holes, because it's something that this movie could easily have had a ton of.
Oh yeah,
and
there is a lot of coincidence, but it's a story. It's not real.
Yeah, exactly. It's like of course coincidence is going to happen. Like coincidence happens in real life, so you can throw in a certain measure of it and it still work. You know, when we were kids watching this movie, we'd never seen anything quite like this. And
no, not at all.
Specifically the part that we had definitely never seen anything like is the third act, when the wet bandits, Harry and Marv, have realized Kevin is definitely there by himself. We are going to come back at 9 o'clock on this specific night, and we are going to break into this house. And Kevin has gone through his own hero's journey, so to speak, has kind of become a better person, and realized that he knows they're coming back. He's overheard them say that they're going to be back around 9 o'clock, and he is going to do what it takes to defend his home. So he's got this big battle plan mapped out of where he's going to lay the traps out. I got to tell you, man, whenever I was watching this movie as a kid, it's like I'm counting down to the moment we're going to get to that bit. And watching it back as an adult, I'm like, there are so many points right as these traps are first starting to go off that Harry and Marv should have just said, nope, we need to go to the hospital right now.
Yes.
So many concussions, so many severe burns, and my God, poor Marv's feet.
Oh God, I know.
Somebody had it in for Marv's feet in this movie. I mean, he steps on a nail, and that is a cringe-worthy moment.
It is. And I always, like, I'm always like, I'm just glad you don't actually see it go in.
Yeah, it's like he's got...
But you do see him step on those ornaments, and...
They explode. Especially
that, yeah, that other one, that last one he gets, like, just with the side of his foot, always makes me like, no.
Yeah, it's like, you feel it. And of course, I mean, Kevin is a sadistic little bastard. He may have, like, improved as a human being, but he's still pretty sick.
Yeah.
He heats up the front door handle to be red hot, and poor Harry walks right by it, doesn't even notice that that's a thing, and grabs it with his bare hand, holds on, but he holds on. That's the nuts part of it. Like, if I had touched something, like, just felt the hot right on the ends of my fingers, I let go immediately. He holds on and is forever branded with the McAllister M in the palm of his hand.
Fun fact. As a child, I did not realize that the M was for McAllister. I thought that it was some doorknob company that whose logo was an M. There were a lot of things, like, just like things I didn't get about the world that were exacerbated by this movie. Like, I thought there was an M brand doorknob. I thought that before you dial the area code, you dial something called the line rose. That's not a thing. It was because the cops were talking to each other. One of the cops was named Rose, and Sergeant Balzac says, "What line, Rose?"
It's weird how we hear things as kids, and it just doesn't work whenever you're an adult.
Oh yeah, I was like, okay, so in America, our line rose is one, and then you do, and then you do the area code, and then the phone number, and I guess in France the line rose is two.
Looking back at the horrible traps that Kevin sets for these guys, which one do you think was most likely to have killed them? At what point do you think they actually die?
So they are dead after the paint cans.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Marv especially. So Marv might have died after the iron, because the iron had more velocity behind it because it was falling straight down.
Sure, he's definitely got a concussion.
Yeah. And then, if not, then definitely from the paint cans. Harry, paint cans.
I don't think they...
He might have survived beyond that. Like, if he survived the paint cans, he might have... Because there wasn't a lot, like, to the head with Harry. Not in the first movie. In the second one, they're both dead.
Oh, when we get to the second movie, I'm pretty sure we say that Marv is going to die immediately.
They're both dead in
this first one, I would say definitely the paint cans. If it didn't render both of them unconscious, which it should have, it's got to be a death blow. The falling from the zip line that Kevin makes from the house to his treehouse, which, by the way, my God, how did he even pull that off?
You can't do it, because that's another influence that this had on so many of our childhoods. We all went in our backyards and tried to make that zip line. You can't do it with a rope.
No, it will not work.
It's got to, you can't get a rope tight enough.
It's like, you can't do that. There's no incline to it, really. It's just straight on, so there is no way that that would ever work. And the gag there, you know, of course, is Harry and Marv are going to climb out on this rope, and Kevin's going to wait till they get far enough out and then cut the rope. Funny joke, wouldn't kill them. But at this point, they've both gone through ice traps, because Kevin soaked down
the stairs.
Yeah, he iced the stairs at both ends of the house. Marv, of course, gets the worst of it, sliding down an entire flight of stairs, where he definitely broke his hip and several ribs.
Yep.
There. So he's...
Harry, of course, I realize Harry got knocked by Marv with the crowbar trying to kill the spider.
Yes, he takes a
chest.
Hard shot to the chest. That's definitely some broken ribs.
Yeah.
So I'm just imagining, you know, what their x-rays at the hospital are going to look like. How many fractured ribs, broken pelvis, hips... cracked skulls, at least a couple, at least in a couple places. I also just noticed something on this recent rewatch that always bugged me as a kid. Kevin makes good use of that movie, Angels with Filthy Souls.
Yes.
Using it to ward off the pizza guy and, at one point, Marv. And whenever I see him using the television in the kitchen, I was always like, that is a tiny TV. There is no way it has speakers like big enough and powerful enough to really pump out the kind of like believable gunfire that, you know, would scare anyone away. As it turns out, there are two giant speakers hooked to that
TV.
There
are. I first noticed those on my latest watch.
I had never noticed them before.
Yeah, I had not either.
And when I saw it this time, I was like, okay, that's how they pulled that. Okay, I can't criticize this movie for that anymore. That used to be...
You can still criticize the fact that Marv apparently doesn't know what television is.
Yes, Marv is clearly an idiot. And, I mean, that's why I love him, is because he's dumb. And he plays that scene really well.
Yes.
And that kind of brings us up to... the end of the film, where we've already talked about how Kevin tricks them into going to the house across the street. He had already called the cops, which I kind of figured he would have done, right when they got there, but he gives them a few minutes to get torn up before actually calling the police. And isn't it amazing how quickly they show up?
It is.
They must have known that was white people's neighborhood.
they definitely
knew that. Check that address. They're like, oh, we better get over there right now, because this dude's house is being robbed. But I got to tell you, they show up real fast for a robbery, but they could give two shits about a kid who might be dying alone in his house.
Yeah, because seriously, the cop's line is, tell them to count their kids again.
Yeah, I was like, wow. Talk about, you know, inept police force. This does not speak well of the Chicago Police Department.
Yeah. One scene I love after the climax, before the end, is just that little scene of Kate McAllister, you know, played, of course, by Catherine O'Hara, and John Candy in the back of the truck having this conversation, and he's just sort of nonchalantly telling a story about leaving his kid at a funeral home all day with the corpse. And this whole, he's just like, you know, about 6 or 7 weeks, he finally came around and started talking again. It's you don't realize just how morbid that story is when you're a kid and you're hearing it. Then you watch it again as an adult, and you're like, oh my God.
Totally a story the devil would tell someone that he's just gotten the soul from. John Candy is either the devil or he's death. And either way, it works. But I actually loved that scene this time. I thought it was incredibly funny. And Catherine O'Hara plays that scene great.
She does. I mean, she's probably I forgot Joe Pesci was in it for a second. But like in terms of like the prestige of the actor's career and stuff, Catherine O'Hara is probably one of the like the top tier in this film.
Oh, absolutely. And her performance is great. She's just, you know, written like an insufferable shrew. But her ability to perform, and then, you know, seeing it through the eyes of an adult, I do see her a little bit differently this time, because she's this, you know, distraught mother trying to get home to her son, and she has thrown caution and like all personal safety and security to the wind in order to make it happen. I mean, she's taking a ride from a group of strange men, polka players at that, who are definitely blowing her eardrums out as they play their polka music in the back of that, what appears to be an old U-Haul truck.
I think it's a budget truck.
An old budget truck.
It's the 90s. Budget was a big thing.
It's a moving truck. It's an old moving truck that they are driving around in. And, you know, full bore playing all these the woodwind, brass, and percussion instruments. And it's like, y'all are in such an enclosed space. This has got to be killing every one of you. But I don't think that that's really the scene with Catherine O'Hara that I have the most appreciation for. The one that I have the most appreciation for now is at the end, because it's such a subtle thing. Because she arrives home, of course, ahead of everyone else. No, she gets inside the house, calls out to Kevin, and they have this really sweet moment together. And Kevin, of course, asks, you know, what happened to everybody else? Where is everyone? And just as his mom's explaining that they really wanted to come, but they couldn't be there, they all come bursting through the door in this like giant Christmas miracle moment. And
yes,
the look on her face when she sees that is, of course, a, you know, pleasant, like, shock surprise. And she asks, wait a minute, how did you guys get here? And he's like, hey, you remember that flight that you didn't want to wait on? Yeah, we were able to get on it, and we arrived just a couple of minutes behind you.
Yes, and I always, like, when he comes in, I always want him to be like, oh, by the way, what did you do with that $500 and those earrings?
But did you notice the look on her face? She's like, at first she seems all happy, but then it's like that's the subtlest little twitch where it's like she's on the verge of an emotional breakdown right now. This is the trigger moment. This is when it happens.
Yeah.
She is just going to lose her shit. And it's just one of those things that I absolutely loved about this film. And, you know, now that we're kind of reaching the end of this episode, it's been fun chatting this movie, but I gotta ask, overall, is this movie deserving of the Christmas classic status that it has been given by our generation?
I would say yes. Because a lot of the movies that have been given Christmas classic status by our generation are in a similar, maybe slightly better, maybe slightly worse place in terms of quality. but you don't watch a Christmas classic necessarily because it's a good movie. You watch a Christmas classic because it's a Christmas classic.
That's true. Honestly, I watch It's a Wonderful Life every year, and I can tell you that it's not really a great movie, but it's one of those that just kind of tugs at the heartstrings in all the right ways.
Oh, absolutely.
And I kind of agree with you there. I think that this movie is the Christmas classic for our generation, for those 90s kids generation. So I think that it's one of those that you do definitely need to watch every year with the loved ones, with the family. It's just a fun time sitting around watching all this just bonkers hilarity occur and, you know, enjoying the pain of others as these Christmas movies often tend to give us.
Yes. What would you say is your favorite scene or shot or sequence?
That is a tough one, but I do actually really like the way the furnace scenes were shot. I think because of all the scenes in the movie, it's the one that I feel like is most from Kevin's perspective.
I like that. That's a good answer. I noticed probably for the first time, I mean, obviously I've noticed the whole movie as many times as I've seen it, but for the first time I really, when I watched it the latest time, I really loved when he's leaving the church and the children's choir is singing Carol of the Bells, and then the clock starts striking 8, and the music sort of fades from Carol of the Bells into the minor key Home Alone, like, dramatic theme,
yeah,
while he's running home. And they've already established that all the houses have the automatic lights on their automatic timers on their lights. So he's like running through the neighborhood and all the lights are coming up behind him. Like, and it's just this really dramatic shot with this music that's kind of faded in to the background music from something that was actually happening. And it's just the dramatic of just sort of setting up this, oh my God, I have to get home and I have an hour to set up this really elaborate battle plan and make some macaroni.
And he doesn't get to eat the macaroni.
He does not get to eat that macaroni. It looks good.
It really did.
Can we talk about how usually food in movies doesn't look great because it's prop food that has to last through multiple shoots all day? Like, the pizza in this looks good. Pizza in movies looks terrible usually.
It does. Little Nero's, if you were real, I would definitely order pizza from you.
I would. I would not fiddle while your pizza burned.
And I saw that it was a Kraft mac and cheese dinner, by the way. So at one point, and these may still exist, actually. So kind of makes me want to give this a shot and see if it's as good as it looks.
You're supposed to give it a whirl.
I'll give it a whirl.
I'll give it a whirl.
My God, I'll give Macaulay Culkin some credit there. He was pulling this role off really well.
He was. There were a few parts where you're like, okay, this is just a kid reading his lines.
Sure.
But then there's some, like, it almost, I don't know what sequence they shot this in, but it almost feels like as you get further into the movie, he's getting better.
That brings up another interesting thing that the cinematographer did with this movie is Macaulay Culkin was actually going through a growth spurt during the time of filming. So they constantly positioned the camera and other actors and him in ways to make him always appear the same height.
Oh, I did not know that. I learned something.
So that's.
I do know that they contracted out the scene where Marv gets shot in the face.
Yeah.
The BBs were hand-painted in that animation. They contracted that out to a guy out of his garage.
I got to tell you, Kevin's a hell of a shot with that BB gun to hit Marv right between the eyes instead of hitting him in one of his eyes, which is the far more likely, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, shoot your eye out. I wonder if that was supposed to be a reference. That movie was not. At that point, that movie was not a big deal. Like, I feel like The Christmas Story, it came out and got forgotten, and then it just had this resurgence like 15 years later.
Yeah, it was not a thing in 1990. It was a few years. It was probably like mid or late 90s whenever TBS and TNT started just bombarding us with that.
I saw it in 1990, and I was like, what is this movie?
Like, I remember seeing it sometime around that time, too, and thinking, you know what? This is not as good as it was advertised to me.
Yeah.
And
It was great until it started coming on the 24-hour cycle and all that.
Yeah, that is definitely one of those things that has just been ruined over time because people want to play it over and over and over again.
Yes.
It's like, just once will do. But I also do consider that a Christmas classic as well, if we're you know, being honest.
It is, and it's one of them. And like, if it was just one that came on once a year, it'd be one thing. Yeah. But you know, I don't necessarily watch it every year, but I watch it maybe every other year.
Well, I definitely watch Home Alone every year.
Yeah, I do too.
That's one that I think has kind of become a family tradition, right up there with It's a Wonderful Life, with National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and of course the Christmas classic Die Hard.
Oh, that's apparently a controversial statement now.
Yeah, apparently one of the main star of the film does not agree that it was a Christmas movie, but you know what? I don't care.
Oh, I'm not even talking about the stars, or I'm not even talking about any sort of authorial intent. I'm talking about Twitter hates the idea that people think Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
Ah, well, Twitter can suck it.
Yeah, pretty much.
And speaking of that, if people want to discuss our opinions on this movie, whether we're right or wrong, you can hit us up on Twitter. You can find me at Russell_Sellers. And where can they find you, Sam?
You can find me at Mr. Woodles, and Mr. is spelled out.
Awesome. And definitely hit us up with your thoughts on Home Alone as a Christmas classic. When do you think Harry and Marv died? Is Kevin going on a real hero's journey here? Does he change enough? Do any of our little fan theories really hold up, or can they be scrutinized? We want to hear it all. So hit us up on the old Twitter machine. Follow Place to Be Nation Pop on Facebook. You can find their page. Click like. Find all the other great shows here on Place to Be Nation Pop, of which there are quite a few. Too many to name, but you'll be hearing all about them in the ad at the end of the show. So, Sam, I think that about wraps us up for this first episode. This was a good time.
I think it was, too. And I look forward to doing the next movie. Do we know what we're doing next yet?
You know, we haven't really decided, but I think we should decide between a couple of different movies.
Let the listeners decide.
There we go. Let's give them. I'm going to give them two different options for movies for us to explore the next time around. One is going to be the vastly underrated Disney live action classic, The Rocketeer, or the teen, not quite sex comedy that predates American Pie and actually inspired the creation of this very podcast, Can't Hardly Wait.
Ah. Interesting.
So,
I will say on The Rocketeer, if you want to talk about movies with great scores, speaking of, John Williams on Home Alone, you got James Horner on The Rocketeer.
You do. That is a tremendous point. And I will say that I still love, for better or worse, that Can't Hardly Wait soundtrack. Not the score, because the score doesn't basically exist.
That's true. But in Home Alone, you get the best of both worlds. This was Home Alone. I did put this in my notes, and I am going to throw it in here at the end. This movie was my introduction to Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, and Oh Holy Night. Those are among my favorite Christmas songs ever.
And that is a great point. This movie did actually have pretty tremendous music, even outside of the John Williams score. So, wow, this movie just keeps gaining points.
Like, absolutely.
There's nothing... You know, I mean, we can criticize it all day long for just being absolutely absurd, and you, of course, would never have this happen today. Cell phones exist, people. This can't happen anymore. But with that said, we've had a great time here on the first episode of 90 Nothing. We hope that you guys will join us again for our second episode, which will be coming out in January. So with that, we wish you all very happy holidays. Hope you have a great time enjoying all of the Christmas classics, especially Home Alone, and we will see you next time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Kimball here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling Warzone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB In Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.